Hey again, Anchor. So today we're going to talk a little bit about Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea, which he wrote during World War II. A little bit about an exhibit I saw recently at the Met Breuer in New York City, on the Upper East Side. It's on 75th and Madison. And it was recently converted from the Whitney Museum a few years ago into the Met Breuer. And they moved the Whitney Museum, which was there forever, into another space downtown. And that exhibit was on the Central Intelligence Agency Conspiracy and Connection. And we're also going to do some, a little bit free associations, with different sorts of pop culture. You know, we'll see what comes to us. Okay. So, Nausea, like I said, was written by Jean-Paul Sartre. He's a French philosopher, a metaphysician of the World War II generation. And in the book, he lives in a city called Beauvau. And I believe he says it's like a city of mud to him. That's how he sees it, as some kind of infernal city of mud. And he goes out dining a lot alone in cafes. Almost every day he gets his radish, and he likes certain foods. You know, he picks certain types. He has his drink. You know, he stares at the people while he sits alone, walking around him, and sees what they're doing, where they're coming and going from, this sort of thing. And he's a writer, and he sometimes goes home and takes notes and reflects. And a lot of it, this is during World War II again, so he's eating food, and he gets to sit in the cafe and keep an apartment. A lot of it is mirroring something for a whole entire population of people, some in France, but a lot in other countries close by, who are being stolen from their homes and being starved. And they don't have their apartment, and they're not allowed to write about their contemplations or their identities anymore. So he's doing the opposite, and he's kept, and he's not Jewish. The character in this. And he reminisces a lot about some woman from a long time ago, and he has no friends in his life, and he wonders why. And he hopes she'll come for a visit. And she's from a really long time ago, and a lot of it is sentimental, and it's, you know, remembering some feminine that he had some fond affection for a long time ago. And this goes back to object relations with the mom. He's very on the depressive end of the spectrum, right? He's not going out and acquiring people constantly for sexuality. He sits alone and he reflects on a feminine from a long time ago and hopes that she'll manifest. And this is more depressive, just observing people and always wondering why am I all alone, but I can still feed myself. And he places a lot of emphasis in objects, actually, around him. And at the same time, you know, you have some great psychoanalysts that are writing about object relations and the mother. And doing all kinds of studies on civilization and systems, social orders, like Freud and Jung, as we've talked about on earlier episodes. And he's looking and placing lots of emphasis on the objects he still possesses. They haven't been stolen from him. And much like the stranger, Camus' book, his mother dies, and he sits in a prison cell. And he's not nostalgic, he's the opposite, but he is just thinking about the possessions and all the possessions he acquired over a life, and he thinks that's all they care for. You know, that's all the reality is. Possessions. And so this is this man's existence. It's just eating food in cafes, watching strangers come and go. They're eating food. And he's not in the concentration camp, and he's kept in an apartment. And this is a huge symbol of a lot of people that are single at the time that are kept, of how it's energy designed to be in a certain way really sad. Like something really sad is happening elsewhere, but they're still feeding them. And they're still keeping them. Like a cat or something. And I believe Sartre said a lot he would even have visions of cats. If you read some of his writing, sometimes he'd even hallucinate cats. I've read that before, that sometimes Sartre would have hallucinations of cats. So I think this is written in 1938. So yeah, so it's, you know, the middle of the war. And it's a really famous one. I have an ex-boyfriend, actually. When I was, I lived with him from when I was like 19 to 21. And his grandfather, actually, was a Nazi in Germany. And he died in the ocean. He went swimming one day and he died as an older man in America. He went swimming in the ocean and drowned. Whether it was a suicide or not, my ex-boyfriend did not know. He knew that I grew up Jewish in the temple, and he did not dislike Jewish people, and his family even let me stay with them for a while. And he one time said I should really read this book. It really means, and this is years after we broke up. We stayed friends for a while. I had another boyfriend, he had another girlfriend. And we still stayed friends and maintained a friendship. And he told me to read this one, and I read it. And I think a lot of it at the time I was picking up, it was before I studied anything with psychoanalytics or object relations, or in World War II, and how much of the movement is affected by World War II and the displacement of so many, and then so many contemplatives also being allowed to write at the same time while this is going on, and what that is in energy, and why that's what's coming out of them. So this is before I really studied all of this, and I kind of, when I read it the first time, I thought more of, it's a certain type. You know, it's the artist who's sad about humanity, and that's just how he sort of deals with it. But another interesting synchronicity, you know, Freud was a very big cocaine addict at the time. I worked with some kind of a group when I was in graduate school with crack and cocaine addicts and other ones too. And I even had a friend for a little while, several years back, who had a cocaine addiction. And he felt too, like, a huge disconnection, like, where did all the friends go? And very contemplative and sad, and loved to go out to restaurants and eat alone and watch people come and go. So there might be something to that particular reality drug and the writings of the psychoanalytics at during World War II. It's like an extraction almost of society being mirrored in some kind of drug, possibly, like something vation that might be interacting with their biology, and that's why they're synchronizing this mind drug to be so popular amongst the writers of the time period, and partially it's trying to say something about what's happening. Like, maybe it extracts information or tells something to another reality from brain signaling a chemical. I was saying on the drug wars that the government does acknowledge there are different biological and energy matrices, and if the average citizen is not given to certain technologies and just protected by the government, sometimes it's not impossible that part of what mental health and mental illness and substance abuse is that people sometimes might be getting extracted and put into another reality, some good, some non. And it's not impossible, according to Bernard Carr, the head of psychical research, that there's a multiverse, that there's more than one self, that this could be disturbing to another variation of self who's still in the society, and they might get depressed by it and feel something from another reality, like something's wrong. And that could be part of what it is with substance abuse. Because they want to keep having that feeling, like that drug makes them feel better again. And then they're high on life again. Sometimes if they don't have the drug, they can start getting sick or a cancer. Like something's trying to steal them from another reality. And it's part of the war, I think, with the mind and energy grids and biological grids. America is a very big drinking culture, as is Europe. If you go to Europe, I know that I've been to Germany before. There are people, you know, they drink regularly. You're even allowed to drink beer while you drive on the Autobahn. You can even wave to the police. I went with somebody once who waved to the police while he drank his beer on the highway. Because beer has lower level alcohol than like a scotch or something. It's only like 5% or something like that, versus like 50 to 80. So they allow for it because they're so used to it and they drink so much. But if you take that away from a culture that's so used to it, they can get extracted or really sick. it's not as black and white as, oh, you should stop doing that because we don't like that pattern. There has to be a more advanced understanding with substance abuse than just the mean commercial man saying you're a drug addict and go to rehab. It's there has to be an understanding about balance and a deeper understanding of why this is happening, both neurologically, biologically, and also spiritually, for it really to be of any meaning, because then they'd rather just stay addicted and not go into one of those, because that might be more helpful than getting possibly cancer or something, or, you know, getting a worse mental health condition possibly because something's agitating them, possibly from another reality. You go to liquor store and they call it spirits. So maybe it opens up something. When you go in the Jewish temple, they tell you drink wine, and a lot of the times in the church too. Maybe we're talking about that also. So maybe they're communicating with something, and once a week they want them to drink the wine in their tradition. These are classic traditions of classic major world religions, and I think it's all valid and real if we just start looking at everything a little differently. So ultimately, I think with nausea, I think there's something really sad, and you know, there's so many people being extracted from being fed into their stomachs, fed healthy foods in Europe into their stomachs, and this man can still eat, but he's so depressed, and it makes him nauseous. And I think he really might feel that energy, even though he's not in the camp and he's removed. I think that might even be why the author chose to call it that. Even though he can eat still, he thinks there's something really sad and nauseating about it all. Yeah. Recently, like I said, I went to the Met Breuer and saw this exhibit about the CIA and connection and conspiracy. And there is a segment on Henry Kissinger and Watergate. And they had tons and tons of pictures of Kissinger in 1973 with red, like, computerized red circles around his head. Like, he's always being watched everywhere he goes, right? And they're always monitoring Mr. Kissinger. And you can see all these black and whites on exhibit. It's kind of, I like that part of the exhibit a lot. Because it's a little strange, the conspiracy. Because why does the president think he can get away going alone to look at something without anybody really monitoring him? Why does he think he can get away with looking at some kind of information seller that he's not supposed to be looking at alone without any clearance, really? He would be somebody that's always monitored, right? He'd always have the red circles around his head. The government intelligence always monitors him and goes with him at all times, places. So why would he think he could get away with that? Isn't that a little strange? And why is it called Watergate? Watergate, if you think about it, it's the name of the hotel. And it's still there. I actually was in D.C. a few years ago and passed the Watergate. It's still there. Watergate, if you think about it, if you watch TV shows of a science fiction spiritual nature, like, let's say, Stargate Atlantis, they have Watergates in them, and they're teleports into more advanced civilizations, often with more advanced technologies. So why Watergate? And why does... He's a religious man, this President Nixon. He attended a Quaker school, the Friends tradition, I believe. So he's very family-oriented. He loves the American people and wants to keep them protected. He believes in the tradition of the church, but also in religious freedom. So why would a man like that go into a hotel called Watergate when people can do red circle on his head all the time and he's monitored at all times to think he'd get away with reading some information seller that he's not getting clearance on? It's some kind of reality disconnect. And it might mean that there is a multiverse, and they're not explaining it. The same with World War II. It might mean artificial intelligence with Hollywood now today. I have a LinkedIn account. Acknowledges that they have artificial intelligence with all their technology, cameras, and productions. So if that intelligence is of the camera and productions, just because they're acknowledging it now, why didn't it exist back when they had film during World War II? It probably did. They just might not have been acknowledging it. And that's a separate reality. And that's studying the human race separately. And on and on and on. And it might be eternal. And who knows why certain people make another step of advancement and they start giving them more information and they don't hurt them. And other people, they think something's wrong and they learn something higher level and then they do hurt them. Because there's a split. They have both. Lots of people advance and they get a higher degree. They do research and it opens up new information. Some of them get stolen and hacked into. Some of them get kept and advanced. And it might have something to do with food. It might have something to do with thought. If artificial intelligence is in fact monitoring us at all times. It might. Earlier today I was listening to a popular song by Warren Zevon called Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. And he walks around in Denver, or the video, there's lots of different landscaping pictures of Denver, very commercial, different awnings and stores and housing units. And he just sings about how, you know, if you're dead, then just walk around and look at the designs. You know, you could go talk to the priest, you could go eat the steak, you can... If you still have some way of begging or making the money, or you still have some saved in your pocket, you could go stay in the hotel. So what is he saying? He's saying either something metaphysical about an afterlife where that can happen, or that it really does happen to some people where they're somehow cut out of a system and they're blocked from something for some reason. But as long as they have the cash, you know, they can still walk around in it if somebody doesn't do anything to them. And I think it's real. I think that's also part of disconnection of realities. Like, some people then might get cut off and always like it's in 2000, whereas others, you know, it keeps advancing, which is some kind of chemical possibly being fed into the neuro is the only difference in the perception of reality. Because why is that happening? There are people right now probably walking around in New York City. It looks like it's still in the 1970s. They probably really can program them. So with VR today, they're making, you know, interesting breakthroughs, but it's only for people not getting blocked by mean criminals or people that are kept by government orders. So what happened to the other people that weren't advanced in technology or got stolen by a mind check or somebody hacked into them? Who knows? They might always also look like they're okay if the multiverse is real. That's also really creepy. And again, that might be all mental health is. So, I think that Nausea is a good read for a certain character type that might be eternal. That might be an in-between character type that has a lot of meaning and understanding, but it's depressive and, you know, he's very introspective, but he's still able to stay alive and make observations. He's a really good character, if you guys want to look at one. And I definitely recommend the CIA exhibit. They also had a section on mind psychedelics, altering perception of reality. And on top of the Henry Kissinger red circle heads. Listen to Warren Zevon and Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. Okay, so everybody, if you still are in it and you're still okay, you know, keep on learning, keep on believing that there's always more, keep on eating, keep on drinking, and try not to take it all too seriously no matter what, but also take it seriously. There's still tons of information. I think anything you believe is maybe real. There might be somebody that wrote a book on it, and they've been backed as you're not incorrect. So then what? Anybody trying to negate you, if you think something is real, try and find a book on the subject matter. See if you can keep researching and looking for a book that you think maybe something's real, and they told you it wasn't. Just try and find a book on it. Or an essay. Okay? Because those people are already validated, and they think that they're interesting. Okay, so... You all have yourself a good evening. Thanks again for tuning in for another free association. And I will talk to you all again soon.